Balba took another gulp of water and put the flask down. Satalia looks after the elves, so she'll only send the fine day for you guys. The humans are giving thanks to Palandiel and we praise Vrakus. That's the way of it, she said amicably. She pointed over to the right where the sun was going down. The day is not over yet. She looked at the white metal armor. She had never seen it before. The elves were all in new clothing, all 200 of them, in white and pale colors, a dazzling sight in the sunshine. Their new appearance reminded her of something, but she couldn't think what. "You are right there, Balba Chiselstrike of the Stone Teasers," responded the elf apologetically. "I wanted to praise the work you have done here. It is excellent. The diamonds will be safe here." She nodded in acknowledgement and gave a shy smile. "Would you like some?" she offered her flask. The elf stretched out his armored hand and took the bottle. "Thank you." He sniffed at the contents first to find out what he would be drinking, then placed the opening to his lips and froze. "By Satalia," he whispered, pointing south. "Do you see what I see?" Balba looked where he was pointing. The escort force for the diamond had appeared between two hills and was passing a wood whence an attack was being launched. The girl saw a huge black monster capering around amongst the tiny forms of the soldiers, swinging a scythe-like weapon. From time to time, green lightning bolts shot out, and where they hit home, men fizzled to steam where they lay. "The unslayables have tricked us! They aren't into Borribor! They have sent their evil, misshapen devils here to steal the diamonds before we can place them in safety." The elf dropped the flask, ran down the steps, and put on his helmet as he went, calling out in a language Balba did not understand. The elf troops rushed to their white horses and thundered out through the southern gate to support Umulanti's soldiers. A handful of their messengers were setting off in other directions to warn approaching groups of dwarves and humans of the acute danger. The fortress commander had the gate shut and called everyone to arms. "I said the day wasn't over yet." Balba was faced with the prospect of a battle. She was not bad with a cudgel, but didn't really consider herself a fighting champion. Now, under cover of the uproar, she left the battlements and went off to hurry her workforce through the remaining tasks while there was still light. Unexpectedly, there was a commotion at the eastern side of the fortress, but Balba remained at the construction site until the humans had completed their work to her satisfaction. Any faulty workmanship would reflect badly on her family and her clan. When all was done, she hurried back up to the battlements, shield in hand. A cloud of dust was making for the eastern gate. And whatever was creating the dust was moving extremely fast, too fast to be a human, an elf, a dwarf, a beast, or an animal. "What happened to Umulanti's troops?" she asked a soldier nearby. The man had gone pale and was clinging to the shaft of his spear. "They're all lying out there by the hills, and they're not moving." "And the elves?" "Gone. Swallowed by the monster," he whispered, and gulped with horror. The sun had gone down, and Goregar was plunged into the half-light preceding the dark of true night with its stars. Torches blazed all round the fortress, chasing away the frightening shadows. Men ran out to bring up the wooden drawbridges, and to set alight tar and brushwood piled in the moats. The first line of defence was in place. Balba heaved one of the rocks onto the battlement wall, ready to cast it down on the attacker. She quickly scratched her initials into the stone, grinning with excitement. 50 paces in front of the gates, the thing halted in the middle of the roadway, having advanced with such speed. It showed itself to the defenders of the castle. The surrounding veil of dust was carried off by the heat rising from the blazing moat. The image that appeared was a mixture of monster and machine. From the hips up, it was like the other monsters, a bastard hybrid of orc and elf or worse, and covered with a solid armor plating of Tionium. there was not a single glimpse of bare skin to be had. Everything was protected by the plates of resistant material from any attack with arrow or missile. Only the face within the open visor showed the armor contained life. But where legs would normally be, there was a large black block, 2 paces high, 2 paces wide, and 3 paces long. The sides of the block were rounded, and the shiny black surface was sloped so that liquids, blood, water, or whatever, would run off quickly. Balba saw the surface had openings and flaps hiding any manner of deathly surprises. Round about, there were sharp spikes of tionium, as long as your forearm. On the bottom of the block were the large wheels used to propel the hybrid along so swiftly, using some invisible power source inside the block.
"A fighting chariot without any horses," judged one of the soldiers. "What the hell have they thought up here?"
"Nothing good," replied Balba. The sight of the thing was making the hairs stand up on the back of her neck.
"Give me the diamond and you shall live," it called out in a clear voice. "My brothers and sisters will soon be here. These walls will not hold us back."
"You shall have your answer,"
the commander called down, lifting his hand and dropping it sharply as a signal. 4 spear-throwing war machines hurled their death-bringing loads toward the creature. Clouds of black weaponry swished through the evening air. The missiles would certainly have hit their target, had the creature not suddenly rolled backwards. The thick covering on the front opened up to form a shield against the spears that reached it. The wooden shafts broke, and the tips splintered, bent out of shape on the rigid tionium. They made not the slightest indentation in the armor. The archers hurriedly reloaded.
"Aim for the wheels! We'll get it this time round!"
The commander turned to the stone catapults.
"Ready to fire?" he called. "When I..."
Then all the lights in Palland went out. Candles, torches, the fire in the moat, it was all extinguished in a trice. Blackness swallowed the twilight. Everything lay in total darkness, with not even a star daring to show its face.
"Fire!"
called the commander. The sounds of the mechanism being released and the ropes unwinding could be heard, and soon there was the rumble of the missiles hitting home. Balba was not convinced she would ever hear this creature's death cry. Bright green runes blazed out in front of the gate. Then there was a powerful bolt of lightning, and the gates themselves were blown open, blasted off their hinges with such force that shards cascaded against the far wall of the fortress. At least now the torches were not refusing their light. So the defenders in the courtyard could see exactly what death looked like just before it struck. The huge block had travelled over the moat and now raced through the courtyard. To the right and the left, blades of tionium shot out, 2 paces long, slicing the armoured soldiers in half. The sight of these truncated soldiers so appalled their comrades that they stood rooted to the spot. At the front, an iron protective apron had opened up, and anyone standing in the way of the machine was forced into the blades or was caught under the jagged edges of the wheels. None survived. Conventional arrows raining down on the vehicle and on the creature itself had no effect. Balba shook off the paralyzing fear.
"Your commander is right. The wheels are the weak point," she called, racing down the steps. "Do you hear me? Shove iron rods in through the wheels, and it'll be forced to stop. Get chains, we can overturn it."
In all the noise and shouting, only a few of the soldiers could hear the brave dwarf woman's advice, but they tried their best to follow her commands. Just before the entrance to the diamond vault, they overtook the vehicle, which was emitting strange noises. It was clicking and ticking, hissing and steaming behind its tionium plating.
"Bring the chains!" called Balba to the men.
The soldiers did not hesitate to obey her orders. They had grasped her meaning. Balba grabbed hold as well, dragging a hook and getting ready to sling it.
"Hook it in thee!"
A loud, rumbling sound made her turn her head to look back at the blasted gateway. A second monster was forcing its way through. Its creator had placed a huge armor contraption round it. Fists of Tionium were battering against the walls, tearing out great parts of the fabric and hurling the rocks at the castle's defenders. The brave soldiers from Weyern were losing their lives in scores against the superior power of this attacker that was kicking at them as if they were vermin. A cage-like globe rolled through their open ranks, coming to the aid of the monster at the entrance to the vault. Balva stopped, her heart in her mouth and her courage melting like lead in a furnace. A third of Tion's creatures, this time with forearms of metal and glass, was climbing up the southernmost battlements. It swung its hands round and sent bolts of green lightning toward the soldiers. Their protective iron armor glowed, and the men vaporized to nothing in the deadly light beams. The commander himself was among the fallen. The rest gave up and ran off screaming. From 1,000, maybe 400 men were still alive. Balva understood that without a Magus, there was no hope of combating these hybrid monsters. The combination of superior machinery, the strength of the creatures, and the unrestrained power of magic could not be matched by any force they could offer. She let the hook fall and ran off, in contrast to the fleeing humans, out through the northern gate. Later, she was to learn that all Weyern soldiers had been annihilated. Chapter 10. Gerdlegard. The north of the kingdom of Goregar. Summer 6241st solar cycle. Boindil stomped off after the undergroundling and made no attempt to conceal his displeasure.
"We're putting ourselves voluntarily into their hands. They attacked our people, it's not good."
"They will give us a hearing. If we can reach an agreement, that's always going to be better than more attacks," said Tungdil.
"And he still hasn't told us what his name is."
Boindil found another reason for his bad mood.
"Oh, yes. And they're friends with the snout faces."
"Just wait and see," advised Tungdil, who had by now had enough of these complaints. Goda was walking next to her master and not getting involved, but judging by her face, he reckoned she would have preferred Boindil to be less argumentative. All three were tense as they followed the dwarf stranger. No one knew what to expect from the coming meeting with their distant relatives from the outer lands. Tungdil watched how the undergroundling moved. His walk was smoother than a Gerdlegard dwarf's rolling gait. He set his feet down in a straight line, not a little way apart like them. He kept his upper body straight and hardly made a sound as his boots touched the ground, in contrast to Ironheart. The undergroundling was so good at moving silently that he might have learned his skill from the Alfar. They marched till sundown, when they found themselves at the foot of three hills in a gentle wooded valley, in the middle of which a bubbling stream arose. The undergroundling led them straight over to the water, called out some incomprehensible words, and sat down at the edge of the spring. He drank from his hand.
"Sundalon will be here soon," he said.
Ironheart ran the head of his crow's beak into the soft moss-covered earth and listened.
"How peaceful it is," he murmured. "Might just as well be one of the elves' sacred places. The only thing missing is the big white stone."
The undergroundling looked up.
"A white stone? With the broker?"
Tungdil remembered that this was the undergroundling's word for elves. It seemed he and his folk were already acquainted with them.
"Yes."
He described the stone, its appearance, and the secrecy the elves had tried to maintain.
"Does that sound familiar?"
"Yes,"
nodded the undergroundling, giving him a sympathetic look.
"We had Broker and their stones in our land, too."
He drank some more water and washed his face without smudging the sign on his forehead.
What does that mean?
Grunted Boindil impatiently.
What do you think?
The undergrounding looked annoyed now.
That we had to destroy them before they destroyed us.
Ireheart looked at Tungdil and gulped.
Did you hear that, scholar?
Loud and clear.
Tungdil sat down on the moss and leaned back against a tree. It was high time they met up with the leader of the undergroundlings. His friend and Goda both sat down next to him.
What do you reckon? Think they like jokes?
Ireheart considered the undergroundling.
Perhaps that will lighten the atmosphere a bit.
But not the asking the way joke.
Goda rolled her eyes. If you must, then try the one about the elf and the dwarf and the forest.
Yes, you're right. The asking the way they might not appreciate.
He placed his fingers round the handle of his weapon.
They're so difficult.
Just because they won't laugh at your jokes. Well, that's certainly a good reason for mistrusting a whole people, said Tungdil lightly. That can be your new motto. Laugh, or I'll thump you.
You could get it engraved on the side of your crow's beak.
Goda laughed out loud.
40 push-ups for you, apprentice.
Boindil's pride was hurt.
No sense of humour, master.
He pretended to be offended.
Not when the joke's on me.
He pointed to the ground.
40, if you please, and write down. I want to see moss on your nose.
Protesting, Goda stood up and did what he had ordered. Tungdil shook his head in disapproval, but Ireheart showed his teeth.
Get your face right down into the moss,
he reminded her after the first 30 push-ups. He was enjoying watching the play of her muscles in the upper arms. Nowadays, this was a sight he was finding altogether more attractive. The undergroundling had kindled a large fire and took no notice of the three dwarves. Flames shot up high into the night sky, sending out a clear signal. As if from nowhere, there they were. 2 dozen silent figures standing between the trees in light brown and black leather armor, leather breeches and boots. Their heads were protected by helmets. None quite like the next. The faces were all hidden. Each shut visor bore a demon visage, engraved on the surface. The effect was uncanny and intimidating. In their hands or on their belts, Tungdil caught sight of short, blackened iron battens, one pace in length. At the end of each batten flashed a slim blade and a hook. It seemed the undergroundlings did not share the dwarf's preference for heavy weaponry.
"Show yourselves,"
said the dwarf, who had led them to the valley. They all opened their visors. Tungdil watched the beardless, serious faces and noted that some of them were women. This aroused his curiosity. They did not seem to have the plumpness of dwarf women that he knew. Their form was taller and slimmer, more like human females. One of the undergroundlings, at first sight, just the same as the others, stepped forward.
I am Sunderland. You want something from me?
He rammed his staff into the mossy woodland floor, lifted the helmet from off his short, light blonde hair, and waited. Tungdil and his companions stood up, and he introduced them all.
We must talk about the diamond, he said, speaking freely. We know now that it belongs to you, but through broker magic, it has become much more powerful. We can't just simply hand it over.
Sunderland reached to his belt and took out a pouch. He opened it and tipped the contents out. Glittering fragments and scintillating dust spilled onto the moss.
That is all that is left of the stones that we and the Ubariu have captured. They were all forgeries.
This did not make Tungdil feel more at ease. Now it was even more likely the genuine stone would fall into the hands of the unslayable siblings. And what they might be capable of doing with its magic power did not bear thinking about.
We demand the return of our property, said Sunderland. It was stolen from us by a broker. It has taken 5-star courses for us to complete our preparations and to have the opportunity to regain it at last. Why don't you just cut yourselves a new one?
and leave us in peace,"
Ironheart suggested, holding his crowsbeak weapon lightly in his hands. Lightly, but ready for use. Goda held her Nightstar ready as well.
"Because only that diamond has the quality we need,"
was Sunderland's sharp reply.
"It would be like having a key that fits but won't turn in its lock."
He looked at Tungdil.
"If the news we've gathered is true, there are still three in the hands of your people, and one has disappeared. Give us those three, and we swear we'll protect them against all threats."
"You didn't manage to keep yours safe the first time,"
Boindil rubbed it in.
"And you can't do it at all,"
Sunderland retorted.
"You can't protect them from us or from the Obariu or from these monsters."
"If you could explain why it's so important, perhaps we could be persuaded to let you have it," Tungdil attempted enticement. To his disappointment, the undergroundling shook his head.
"If we could explain it freely, we wouldn't have kept ourselves hidden in your homeland for so long. Our land and our town are helpless without the diamond. Our enemies are strong, and would attack us at once if they were aware of our weakness."
Tungdil took a careful step forward.
"We are dwarves as you are.
We would never betray you to our foes." He knew that his statement contained a trace of untruth. He suspected that some of the Thirdlings were certainly capable of malice and deceit, but Sunderland did not have to know this. "And anyway, the kings and queens know that it's the undergroundlings, together with the orcs, trying to get the diamonds. You might as well talk about it. Your raids are no secret, Sunderland."
"He is right,"
said the undergroundling who had brought them to the valley.
"Tell him about the trouble we are in, and then let's talk to the kings and queens." "No,"
said Sunderland harshly.
"What happens in this land is not our concern."
"But they don't understand the danger they're in. The broker have put up white stones," continued the undergroundling. "It's starting here like it did with us, Sunderland. We could help avert the worst if we warn the dwarves and the humans."
Sunderland fell silent and thought hard.
"I don't know how you feel about it, but Baldy Patch is starting to worry me,"
whispered Boindil.
"What's all this about the white stones? Does he mean what we saw when we were with the pointy ears?"
"Saw?
You touched it, remember?"
Tungdil said quietly.
"Who knows what it's done to you?"
Ironheart went pale. The nameless undergroundling turned to them.
"Don't trust the broker now, neither their words nor their deeds, nor their smiles. They have been staring too long at the sun and aspire to become like it. They have become blind to everything else."
His tone was insistent.
"It will start with deaths, and nobody will know by whose hand the victims died. Then towns and villages will burn, and there will be no survivors. Your people will suffer losses and will lie dead in the tunnels because the water is poisoned."
"By Vrakas!"
Ironheart exclaimed, horrified.
"Do you hear that? They're describing what's happening in Girdlegard."
He stopped, lifting up his crow's beak.
"Was it you that did that, and now you're all for peace because it'll make it easier for you to get the diamond?"
He lowered his head aggressively between his hunched shoulders.
"I swear by the dwarfs that have died that I shall take revenge on you, if it was you that did this."
"No, it was not us,"
said Sunderland.
"Agreed. You shall learn the history of the diamond. Perhaps then you will believe us."
He sat down and started to relate.
"The stone originated in the deepest mine of Dresdeden. The finder paid for it with his eyesight because it was so dazzlingly bright. It was only possible to view and to cut the diamond when it was covered with a thick black cloth. The gemstone cutter needed 7-star courses to give the diamond its true form. The work took the flesh from his fingertips. His back became permanently bent and his eyes as weak as those of an old, old man. Finally, he finished cutting and polishing the stone. We took it to the Ubario Rune Master,
and he realized why the god Ubar had sent us the diamond. The Rune Master prepared for war. He gathered an army and marched with it to the Black Abyss. Arising from the lightless depths and dark crannies, evil had issued unceasingly to plague us. Ever since the stars started running, evil's progeny had surged out from thence to attack us. But there was also an age-old iron artifact of no apparent use. It had long lost any power it once had wielded. The runes it bore promised to close the Black Abyss forever, if the Star of the Mountains ever returned to it. The Rune Master led us and the Abariu into the midst of our enemies. There ensued a terrible battle waged against creatures more bestial than any you may have known in Girdlegard, but yet blessed with a form of outstanding beauty. Some found their way here, creatures you know as Alphar. We call them Sintoitar. They crawled out of the Black Valley over the mountains and came here. Together with the Ubariu, we fought tirelessly and forced a path for the Rune Master through the Black Army to reach the artifact. That day, many friends and relatives lost their lives, and whole generations were wiped out. Then the beasts realized that a greater danger was threatening them than they had ever known. If you had not seen it with your own eyes, you could never imagine the merciless killing and slaughter. The Rune Master floated up to the artifact. He placed the stone in its setting. It fitted. The stone awoke with dazzling beauty. Splendid and terrible beams of light transformed the ancient machine and brought it to life. Evil's creatures were driven back into the Black Abyss. Most of them had met their deaths at our hands. Only a few of the more harmless ones managed to escape. They no longer presented any danger to us. The artifact wove a veil of impenetrable magic under which the abyss lay captive. Until the day the Broker arrived, overpowered our guards, and stole the Star of the Mountains.
Sundalon dipped his hand into the spring and drank.
So far, the creatures in the ravine have not yet noticed that their prison has been opened. They have sought new escape routes, but the gaps they discovered were always dangerous and difficult to use. Again and again, some of them managed to get out.
He lowered his voice.
If one of them should realize in the course of a sortie that the main exit path is now open, and if it returned to summon the others, they would storm out of the abyss fueled by hatred and fury. They would destroy everything they came across.
He pulled his staff out of the mossy floor and indicated himself.
Us first.
The sharp end now pointed at Tungdil.
Then you. The Alphar are the least dangerous of them.
So, do these hybrid monsters made of beast and metal perhaps come from the Outer Lands?
Tungdil wondered aloud.
Sundalon shook his head.
We know of none such. They must have been born here.
That can't be so. The Alphar and all the dark creatures were destroyed by the Judgment Star. Most of them at any rate,
said Goda, who had listened to the story as intently as the two other dwarves. Sundalon considered this.
Was this Judgment Star a wall of white light that swept over the land?
She nodded. He drew his dagger, plunged it into the water, and held it out with the broadside facing up.
If that is your land, and my finger is the wall of light.
He ran his finger along the metal, wiping off the water.
What remains under the earth?
Large drops collected on the underside of the blade.
You mean the magic won't have penetrated the mountains and the deep ravines?
That is so. We have been to regions where this had been attempted before. There were always some beasts that survived.
Sundalon gazed at the dagger's blade, wrapped in thought.
It didn't work with us. The broker came and stole the stone and waited for the monsters to show themselves, to destroy them by magic so as to gain soul power. But they didn't do her that favor, so the broker left with her retinue. Afterwards, all the broker behaved strangely, and we had to kill them before they destroyed us all.
He put away his dagger.
It wasn't easy to eradicate them, but it had to be done.
He gazed at the dwarf's thoughtful countenances.
They had lost their minds. You won't deny that our elves are behaving strangely, will you?
Boindil asked Tungdil.
I mean more strangely than usual.
We must nurse the injured elf back to health as soon as possible. He is certain to be able to tell us more.
It won't be for nothing they shot at him.
Tungdil nodded to Sunderland.
Come with me to Palland and tell the kings and queens what you have told us. Convince them. There's no other way for you to get the true diamond because you won't ever get inside the fortress walls. I give you my word that no one will take you prisoner, injure or kill you.
He lifted his axe.
I swear this on the blade of keen fire.
The undergroundling with no name nodded to his leader encouragingly, and finally Sunderland agreed.
We shall accompany you, Tungdil Goldhand.
He stood up.
But we would have got into the fortress,
he said with a smile of utter conviction.
Girdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Purista, Summer 6241st Solar Cycle. Tungdil, Boindil, Goda, the Fifthling Contingent, and the Undergroundlings did not have to go all the way to Palland. In Purista, the royal banners of the human realms stirred in the breeze above the city walls, indicating that the mighty rulers of Girdlegard were once more assembled, and the banners were flying at half-mast. The dwarves marched through a town that was eerily quiet. The atmosphere in the streets was muted from oppression and fear, with any pleasures or delights smothered. On the way to the assembly tent, they heard what had happened in Palland, and how the defense force had been destroyed. When Tungdil, Ironheart, and Sunderland entered the Royal Marquis in the early part of the afternoon, humans, dwarves, and elves were debating what they should do next. Goda waited outside, as always. Prince Malin's seat was empty, and on the throne-like chair that had once been Lutacil's, Tungdil saw an elf woman in white robes and bearing the insignia of a sovereign. In her long pale hair, costly gems were set. The bright gaze of her blue-green eyes scanned the newcomers. A successor to Lutacil had been found, and she surpassed all others in her beauty and her presence. She was introduced to him as Princess Rejalin. Tungdil immediately thought of the e-oil. King Bruron received the dwarves with a half-hearted smile, and looked in surprise at the beardless dwarf who was taller than Tungdil by a hand's breadth.
You will have heard about Palland.
Tungdil nodded and bowed to the other rulers.
I was shocked to hear the news. So now there is only one diamond in Girdlegard, and nobody knows where it is.
One?
Said Issachar, deep foreboding in her voice. With her black hair and lined face she presented a dark contrast to Rejalin. The robe of the elf princess made her own sumptuous attire seem inferior.
Were you routed by these beasts as well?
No, I was defeated by Sunderland.
Rejalin stepped to one side to let the undergroundling be seen.
He comes from the outer lands, from a town at the foot of the mountain range, and he is on a quest to regain what belongs to them. Listen to his story.
And Sunderland told them, as previously agreed with Tungdil, about the artifact whose power had stopped up the evil chasm. He told them how the E-Oil had stolen it, without mentioning that this E-Oil was a broker, an elf woman.
We couldn't tell anyone. We feared there would be long, drawn-out negotiations, even though it rightfully belongs to us. We also feared the monsters would hear about the missing artifact.
He stepped up to the table and spread out the fragments of the gemstone copies.
The rulers looked despondently at the shimmering pile of crystalline remains.
Either the beasts already have the real diamond, or the one that's got lost is the one with the incomparable magic power.
Tungjil's voice broke the silence.
I think the beasts have long been in possession of the one that's disappeared.
He turned to address the kings and queens.
We must put all our efforts now into getting it back. Two reasons. It must not be allowed to serve the sinister purposes of the Unslayables, and its power must be used to permanently seal up the evil ravine. Otherwise, Gerdlegard will not be safe.
Rejalin turned her head to one side and observed Sundalin.
You formed an alliance with the orcs to get the stone back, is that correct?
Sundalin wrinkled his face in distaste.
I would never fight side by side with those creatures. The Ubari are honorable and are sworn enemies of the orcs. They are our brothers. Our races were both created by the god Ubar.
They are like the orcs apart from the tusks, aren't they?
Rejalin smiled. For that smile, men would worship her as a goddess. It had no effect on Sundalin.
They are taller in stature than orcs. Their eyes are the red of the rising sun, and their philosophy is 1,000 times better than that of a broker,
he retorted sharply.
If you regard them as your enemy, you must take us as enemies also.
Strange, said the elf woman thoughtfully. And what are broker?
They are like you, but corrupt and false. They pretend to be benign and wise and keen to befriend all other folk. In reality, they are trying to spread their own ideas with no thought for others. They must be eliminated.
Sundalin had spoken in dark tones. He was finding it hard to restrain himself.
He means the Alpha, Tungjil came to his aid. We cannot judge by appearances, Princess Rejalin. Your people know that only too well.
She dropped her penetrating gaze.
I ask your pardon, Sundalin. I did not want to offend.
This is not good news that you bring us, Tungjil Goldhand, sighed King Bruron. It will be best if you set off for Eiderslane straight away with Keenfire in your hand. Prince Malin is laying siege to the caves of Taboribor. We think the monsters are hiding their prize there. It will be extremely dangerous to fight these monsters without a Magus at your side. We have been shown that superior numbers are no threat for them.
He contemplated the wonderful engravings on the head of Tungdil's axe.
Only Keenfire will be able to withstand attacks from the sorcery of the Unslayables and their allies.
As soon as the sun rises, I'll be on my way, nodded Tungdil.
A messenger hurried into the marquee, stepped up to Bruron and whispered to him. Tungdil feared that their planned daybreak departure would already be too late.
We have a delegation wishing to bring us news, said the king, turning to the doorway.
Send them both in.
The curtains parted with a theatrical flourish, and in stepped Rodario, in flamboyant robes as magnificent as any worn by the assembled monarchs.
My respects to you all, mighty sovereigns of Gerdlegard, you humans, dwarves, and elves, one and all.
He made a deep bow. Tungdil was delighted to see his friend. This type of grand entrance was typical. For Rodario, it was in fact quite restrained. No drums, no fanfare, no herald. The kings and queens watched the dramatic approach of the new arrival with amazement, but limited their reactions to an amused raised eyebrow here, an expression of slight disapproval there.
Wherever heroes are gathered and history is written, I must also beat a hand. For who else would take true note and show events on the stage to future generations, if not myself?
Rodario granted the company the benefit of his dazzling smile.
What ho! Lock up your women! The fabulous Rodario has returned, grinned Boindil.
Rodario smiled and stroked his elegant beard, shorter now than Tungdil recalled.
I have not come on my own, your gracious majesties.
I bring you a man who is able to answer many of the open questions puzzling Gerdlegard. He gestured to the door with his cane. A moment later a man appeared. His short black hair and his thin moustache gave him a fleeting resemblance to Fergus, except for how old he looked. He was wearing a simple pair of breeches, a shirt over them, boots, and a cloak. His clothing all seemed too big for him, and flapped around his shrunken body.
"I have come to," he whispered, and threw Adario an uncertain look. "I have come to atone for my deeds. I cannot ask forgiveness for what I have done."
"By Vracus, it really is Fergus,"
Boindil said, horrified. He had recognized the Magister Technicus only by his voice.
"Rodario the Incredible has incredibly managed to dig him out."
"No, I did not dig him out, but freed him, good friend Boindil Doubleblade, on my own. Freed him from the clutches of thirdlings known as Bandilore and Veltega, who have made their home on an island that they can submerge, or bring up to the surface as they choose, in the middle of Weyern's waters." The actor used every rhetorical trick in his repertoire as he described the meeting with Fergus. His narrative arts were such that the entire audience hung on his every word.
"Finally! We swam the 5 miles through the wild waters and arrived at Mifodania. From thence, we journeyed with the travelling Curiosum outfit to reach Perista," he told them, concluding his tale. "So, we have found the culprits who send out death devices to hound the dwarf peoples."
"Masterly, indeed, Rodario," said Issachar graciously. "Magister Fergus, what deeds were you speaking of? Why did you say forgiveness could not be sought?"
"Because not only did I construct the island for Bandilore and Veltega, I built the machines as well," he whispered.
He repeated the account he had given to Rodario. "Through my actions, countless dwarves have lost their lives. It is my fault. More will die. The next device is on its way." He asked for a glass of water.
"You must pronounce sentence on me. I will accept any punishment."
The Marquis buzzed. Tungdil went over to Gandagar to ask for clemency for Fergus. The High King bent forward.
"Do not worry. I am not seeking his life," he said quietly.
Then, raising his voice,
"We shall not hold you responsible, Magister Technicus. Your genius and your injured soul were both abused by the dwarf haters. Our revenge shall be against them, not you. You were their tool. They used you for their malign plans. But we shall never forget the countless victims. We demand of you that you do everything in your power to stop further dread events. For now, you have our understanding. Do not disappoint us."
"You see? Like I said, they can tell the difference. Now, be brave and tell them everything," Rodario said gently, brushing over Gandagar's threat. "They won't hurt you." Fergus sobbed.
"I built the machines," he repeated in despair.
"We have pardoned you," repeated Gandagar.
"No, there are more machines, though."
He told the story through his tears of the malformed hybrid creatures he had adapted, constructed with his own hands. The kings and queens sat, thunderstruck. They listened, horrified and enthralled at one and the same time. It defied imagination.
"I am to blame that they are rampaging through Gerdlegard, killing, maiming, and bringing destruction."
Tungdil watched the elf princess. Apart from himself, she was the only one whose countenance was not a mask of disgust and fascination. On the contrary, she seemed glad. She was assuming, as he was, that she now understood the significance of the pit at the bottom of Weyern's lake. She turned her head abruptly
and looked him in the eyes. He felt she could read his thoughts. Let us look on the bright side of Master Fergus's report. It means there is a new magic source in Girdlegard. Regalin's voice rang out clear and true. And it seems the Unslayables do not know where it is. Those two thirdlings will be clever enough to keep it hidden from them, so that they can hold sway over them and keep them dependent.
Of course!
Tungdil understood at once what she meant. The Magi of Girdlegard left nothing to chance when selecting their own prime locations. They chose to be within the magic force fields, their power source. When the Magi left the fields, they would find their magic diminished after a few spells, he explained. Andukai the Tempestuous and my own foster father, Lot Ionan, once told me how it all worked. Only by using the power of the magic source were they able to perform their incredible feats with words, gestures, and immense concentration. He stopped to catch his breath. I assume these machine monsters function by the same principle. They will have to reload with the magic, never mind what complicated mechanics they employ.
Gandagar slammed his fist down on the table. At last! A weak point, he exclaimed with relief. Magister Fergus, where exactly is this source?
Fergus shrugged his shoulders.
I don't know.
Somewhere at the bottom of Weyern's Lake.
You've no idea?
A clue? Some island in the vicinity?
Issachar gave an agonized groan.
By Palandiel, get thinking, man. It's you we have to thank for this whole ghastly plague. Most of my islands float, Queen Issachar.
Queen Wei came to his rescue.
Even if he had noticed one of them, it wouldn't help us.
Then, said Tungdil Goldhand slowly, we must bring up the island together with its thirdlings and just ask them. We'll be with you there, Gandagar grinned. For a cause such as this, even dwarves shall take to water and defy the curse of Elria.
He looked at Queen Wei.
This is a matter for our folk, your majesty. I shall send you a contingent of my best warriors, dwarves of untarnished reputation, without the slightest shred of a thirdling connection. They will be glad to fill the gaps in the ranks of your own army to make good the losses sustained in the Palant massacre. The island of the Thirdlings will be taken by storm, and the magic source will be protected.
Queen Wei inclined her head in agreement.
I suggest we retire now and convene again in the morning for the last time. Then the groups will leave and do what has to be done, announced King Brauron. At long last, we have an opportunity to do something about the dire threats that paralyze our native land. Palandiel will protect us.
May I alleviate the shock and worry?
Offered Rodario, bowing deeply.
I invite the mighty rulers this evening to attend an exclusive premiere performance in the Curiosum. The production is an exquisite comedy which should restore some laughter into these serious times. If we lose the ability to laugh, we have lost everything.
Tungdil turned to Ironheart.
Your brother in spirit. Another who enjoys a joke. Nobody tells them like I do, the warrior replied quietly.
Rodario grinned.
Entrance will of course be free of charge. I shall not discourage you, however, from making a small donation to reward the troop for their skill and artistry.
To his surprise, the monarchs promised to attend. It would be the most important performance of his entire life. Tungdil, Ironheart and Goda had found a big room near the square where Brauron's new palace was being built and the assembly marquees stood. The undergroundlings were staying in the same house. The landlord was a little more puzzled by them than by the dwarfs, now a familiar sight. They were brought a decent meal and a large jug of beer. Goda was getting a lesson from the warrior twin about standing firm in battle. Boindil was showing her the various methods of sweeping an opponent off his feet with the edge of a shield.
"You have to make yourself heavy," he explained, ramming his own shield against hers.
There was a loud crash, and the dwarf woman retreated 2 paces.
"Make yourself heavy, I said," he scolded.
"But I had my whole weight on the floorboards," she protested.
"Standing firm is a skill."
He waved her back into position.
"But it's more than just having broad feet and sturdy thighs. Stand so that your center of gravity is between your 2 feet, then bend your knees slightly and bring your head in and down,"
he demonstrated.
"Now try to push me over."
Goda lifted her shield, took a run up and slammed against her instructor. The noise was ear-splitting. Boindil didn't budge.
"That's what I meant by making yourself heavy. It's important to be able to withstand an opponent's attack. An orc in a fury, if need be."
He rubbed his belly.
"And they're twice as heavy as me."
He tapped her shield.
"Try again. We'll practice all night if we have to."
"Ho, stop there," called Tungdil, who was writing notes on the discussion in the assembly. There were still some puzzles. Speaking to Balba Chiselstrike, the only one to escape from Palland, had not thrown up any clues. She couldn't recall any of the elf runes on the wheeled monster. Even Fergus could not remember any elaborate runic designs. But Tungdil knew the rune was there. Each of the creatures had been carrying one. Now he was annoyed not to have peace and quiet to work things out. "I'm trying to think. How can I when you two are carrying on like a couple of vangers?"
"What are you trying to work out?"
"It's time for fighting now, not thinking, scholar." Ironheart's eyes were blazing.
"We haven't found any orcs yet, but these machines are quite something."
He whirled his shield around.
"Ha! I'm itching to measure my skills against one of the undergroundlings."
"Haven't you already done that?" Tungdil remarked. "You lost, didn't you?"
"That wasn't a proper fight for Vrakka's sake. That was like trying to catch an eel."
He gave himself a shake.
"When I say fight, I mean axes and blades and heavy weapons, crashing and clattering. I don't really think they're related to us."
The way he said it, he'd already made up his mind. Dismissive of them. Tungdil looked up. "They are dwarfs. Nothing can change that." "Well, they see themselves as brothers to those orcs." Goda's answer was too swift. It seemed the two of them had already been discussing this during their combat exercises. "Their god created them at the same time. What was it they call him?"
"Uba,"
Tungdil supplied. He put his arm on the back of the chair, his expression reproachful. "I'm glad you two agree about something for once. But you sound just like the elf princess." Ironheart made a face.
"Scholar, we can't make common cause with the undergroundlings. They're taller than us. They fight differently, and they don't even use axes. Only this."
He made the shape with his hands.
"This toothpick thing. No, we weren't made from the same stuff as them."
He nodded at Goda, who charged at him again. Another mighty crash. "You're being unfair," said Tungdil, shaking his head.
"And you were obsessed," the dwarf countered. "I saw how you were constantly watching them. It was obvious you wanted to talk to them to find out more. It stops you being objective. That's science for you."
"On the contrary, my judgment is extremely objective." Tungdil wasn't taking this lying down. "I'm probably the only one in all the 5 dwarf folks who is looking at them clearly. From everything you say, it's obvious how blinkered your viewpoint is. And you're one of the few who are more open to new ideas."
"And you have the right to judge others?"
Ironheart charged Goda, who was steadier on her feet this time. This earned her a nod of respect, and a long gaze right into her eyes. Perhaps overlong. She lifted her shield to cut his stare short.
"I'm not judging anyone," Tungdil sat, sighing over his notes.
He was regretting this conversation. He knew it was no use talking to a stubborn dwarf like Ironheart. Every word would be misunderstood.
I'll speak to Fergus later to see if I can find out anything else about these creatures' weak points. We won't stand much of a chance without that knowledge. None of us. Not even you.
We'll see. My crow's beak always finds a crevice to latch onto.
Ironheart was offended.
Come on, Goda. We'll go and practice outside.
She rolled her eyes and followed him. But once the others had left the room, Tongdil was not able to regain his train of thought. Instead, he mulled over Boindil's words. His friend was right. He was indeed fascinated by the undergroundlings. He knew hardly anything about them apart from their appearance being different from his own. He didn't know how they lived in the Outer Lands, nor what the values and philosophy of their community might be. He stood up and went over to the window to look down onto Parista. Its roofs, smoking chimneys, laundry fluttering on the washing lines, all gave an impression of settled permanence. People had found the place they wanted to remain. They had started their families there. This all ran contrary to his own feelings. He did not feel at home either with the dwarf folk, or with the exiles, or with the humans. Even Belindis could no longer give him that feeling of belonging. He was a loner, a fighting scholar. Or, perhaps, deep down, he did not really want that safety, that sense of belonging. Am I destined to be an eternal wanderer? Should I maybe go back to the Outer Lands with the undergroundlings? To help them restore the diamond to its rightful place? He spoke quietly. Will I find happiness, Fracas? He looked at the jug of beer. The alcohol was calling to him, its smell reminding him of nights he had spent under its influence. When drunk, he had ceased to quibble and worry. Tongdil tried to resist the temptation, but still he moved over toward the table. Just as he stretched out his hand to the handle of the jug, there came a knock. He dropped his hand at once and went over to open the door. In the doorway there stood an undergroundling, a woman. He had noticed her on the journey. Her skin was as dark brown as a nomad's, and she had kept near him on the march. She wore a beige tunic embroidered with thorny branches, fastened at the front with lacing but showing part of her breasts. Now he could see her for the first time without the rather intimidating helmet. He stared at her shaven head. He had not been prepared for that. A woman without her crowning glory. "May I come in?" she asked him with a smile. Her speech had the attractive lilt of a foreigner's. "Of course," he said quickly, stepping aside to let her in. She was a hand's breadth taller than he was. "What message does Sundalon send?" She strolled around the room, stopping to examine the sketches in his little notebook. Her clear blue gaze alighted on the helmet he had drawn. "You've drawn mine." "Yes. Should I not have done that?" "It doesn't worry me." She held out her hand, and he noticed a wide scar on it. "I am Circa." He shook hands with her. "Pleased to meet you. My name you already know, I think." He waited in vain for her to tell him Sundalun's message. "It would be strange if I didn't," she replied with another smile. He cleared his throat. "Forgive me if I was staring just now. The dwarf women of Girdlegard have a different skin colour, and they don't shave their heads. They wear their hair long." He was feeling awkward. "I don't suppose we have much in common," said Circa. "Sundalun tells me you're a scholar." She took up the little notebook and turned the pages. "You are interested in everything that's new?"
"I am."
Tongdil was caught unawares by the dwarf woman's behaviour. She suddenly stepped toward him, tossing the notebook onto the table. She put her hands to his face and pressed a kiss onto his lips. He did not try to push her away.
"I like you very much, Tongdil," she confessed, running her fingers over his chest. "I would love to show you something new, if you'd let me do that."
There was no doubt what the offer entailed. "You undergroundlings indeed have little in common with our dwarf girls," Tungdil stated, with the touch of her lips still felt on his own. He had enjoyed the kiss a great deal. So much that this time it was